From where Winston stood, it was just possible to read, picked out on its white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
America's most dangerous enemies are not the Islamic radicals, but those who sold us the perverted ideology of free market capitalization and globalization. They have dynamited the very foundations of our society. In the 17th century, these speculators would have been hung. Today, they run the government and consume billions in government subsidies.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio. I'm Esther Averam. On the Ground is your D.C.-based show covering the social justice activism in the streets and in the suites of power, like our recent coverage of the People's Tribunal on the Iraq War, our Black Power at 50 in D.C. series, and weekly coverage out in the community that you don't hear anywhere else. We are living in times that demand real news and unvarnished truth without the corporate spin, without the administration spin. Well, today's show, the focus is all about truth. Lies turned into truth and truth turned into lies. It's about the U.S. supposedly waging wars for peace and how a now permanent so-called war on terror that enriches the war state, the war economy, and warlords only leads to more war in more countries around the world. And then Trump and his minions appeal to xenophobia and racism by not allowing into this country those from countries that we have destroyed. On the home front, we're looking at confirmation to head federal agencies, people who have only worked in the past to destroy those very same agencies. There are all kinds of lies. Democrats still talking about Putin and Russia interfered in the election when they lost the election themselves. What a madhouse. It's kind of a dystopia. So later in the show, we'll hear excerpts from the audiobook of George Orwell's 1984, which has soared on the New York Times bestseller list. Now to this week's headlines. And we'll start with the author and activist, Professor Gerald Horn, whose most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Well, Gerald, this week our theme is the novel 1984, as you probably heard me mention. What is Orwellian in our world, where there are alternative facts, where science is denied, where white supremacists are being nominated for positions of power, and the new president continues to make these cavalier remarks about military intervention around the world. So I want to get your take on the Orwellian merging with reality in D.C. this week.
Well, the wider point is this rebranding of white supremacy as alt-right, and the fact that the mainstream media is going along with this rebranding, which makes white supremacists and misogynists seem like a rock band. But it's deeper than that. Keep in mind that one of the stories supposedly of the November 2016 election is how a significant sector of the working class was driven into misery, and therefore they saw no alternative but to vote for Donald Trump. But the mainstream media is in a contradiction. Look at your own Washington Post, for example.
It's which not under mine.
you live in Washington, in other words. Which, under the Graham family ownership, was a union-busting shop, which, of course, drove down wages, allowed for more layoffs. So how can the Washington Post credibly report on the economic misery of the working class when they've been a major perpetrator of the economic misery of the working class? This is the kind of Orwellian world in which we reside.
So, you know, I most often hear references to 1984 in terms of truth and lies, but as we'll hear a little later in the show, Orwell's dystopia was also about terror, torture, and a police and military state. And except for people of color and the poor in this country, we have reserved these police and military elements for other countries that we have interfered with, invaded. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, what's striking is Donald Trump's pledge during his campaign that he would unleash the police authority, particularly against our community. He felt that Black Lives Matter and the crusade to restrain the police was something of a fraud. But there's a deeper problem here, once again. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles, where I've been doing research on the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And what's striking in terms of what I'm uncovering is how it was the liberals who wanted internment of Japanese Americans. The real men with hair on their chest wanted something much worse, starting with expulsion and ending perhaps who knows where. I think that the mainstream media has difficulty in reporting on how backwards and retrograde the United States has been historically, not only against people of color, as you mentioned, but also abroad.
Well, you know, when I started thinking about this theme, this 1984 theme, it occurred to me that, of course, Africans and their descendants, you know, I'm one of them, have been living in an Orwellian state in the U.S. for quite some time. Slavery, and as you've discussed in your books and as we've discussed on the show, you know, slavery and Jim Crow were systems of brutal violence and totalitarianism. And I realized that, like, even last year's movie, The Birth of a Nation, which depicted this horrific state, was the target of a systematic campaign to kind of squash it and squash that kind of content.
Yeah, that was very unfortunate. And it pains me even to think about what happened to Nate Parker's movie, the movie in which he co-wrote, directed, and starred in. It was a marvelous film, but it was systematically sabotaged. But once again, how can we get to the truth when you have such campaigns of sabotage unfolding? This is a particularly relevant moment to mention this because we're in the midst of Black History Month, African History Month, started by the historian Carr G. Woodson over a century ago. And this is precisely the time that we should be highlighting the themes that Nate Parker so dramatically and creatively sketched. But unfortunately, the film has now left theaters and is now on DVD.
Yeah, well, I think it actually does come out on DVD this month, so maybe we can remind people of that and it can still be supported. So, speaking of movies, what is your take on the media's role in creating this world of doublespeak? And that's one of the terms in 1984, this or newspeak, you know. In all this talk about fake news and alternative facts, I had to remember the media's role in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and the recent presidential election, actually, when fake news and alternative facts ruled the day. And, I mean, from your position in the academy, I'm wondering if you think this crisis isn't also about a dumbed-down public and a population that more and more is not trained to be critical thinkers.
Well, obviously, in order to execute these policies, which obviously harm the majority of the people in this country, you have to have a systematic campaign to miseducate the population of this country. And keep in mind that the aforementioned Carr G. Woodson, one of his leading books was entitled The Miseducation of the Negro. Now, unfortunately, it does not stop with the Negroes. In fact, in some ways, the Negroes have gone beyond miseducation compared to the rest of the population of this country. I know that a particular interest of yours is the so-called Prof Watch, Professor Watch, where there's a systematic attempt to crack down on professors who try to inject critical thinking into their classroom. And I have the dubious distinction of being on that Prof Watch list, although it's not something that I'm particularly proud of.
Well, I know that I've seen a number of articles where professors say that they were proud of it. And unlike during the McCarthy era when professors on the left were targeted, the National Association of University Professors or whatever have come out to attack this neo-McCarthyism. Whereas during the 50s, they actually kind of succumbed to the bullying and the rhetoric of Joseph McCarthy.
Well, let's hope that trend continues. Certainly all of us must be heartened by the marches and protests at airports concerning the so-called Muslim ban enacted by President Donald J. Trump, the women's marches that took place the day after his inauguration. Certainly, I'm heartened by the fact that the buzzword of the day seems to be resistance. And certainly during Black History Month, when we're marking the contributions and the struggle of a people whose motto in the 19th century was, let your motto be resistance, it seems that all of us could take a cue from Black history during February 2017.
Okay, well, thank you, Gerald. Thank you for your thoughts this morning and for your encouragement and call to listeners to support Pacifica Radio. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that was author and activist Professor Gerald Horn, whose most recent book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Now, from protests against immigration bans to petitions to White House rallies, there are other happenings in D.C. with national and international reverberations. Hundreds of people turned out Thursday night for a General Assembly meeting of the Movement for Black Lives, D.C. Nationally, the movement is challenging the suggestion from Trump surrogates that Black Lives Matter may be designated as a terrorist organization, and the nomination of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, who has fought voting rights and other rights for African Americans won during the Civil Rights Movement. Locally, activists continue to demand justice in the case of Terrence Sterling, an unarmed black man shot to death on September 11th of last year. And they are urging elected officials to reject recent legislation to increase the size of the city's police department and instead implement the NEAR Act, legislation passed in 2015 but never implemented that activists say will empower community members to directly mediate violent situations before they happen. Now, just as water protectors and defenders of public land continue to oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline project in North Dakota, a determined coalition here in D.C. has fought so far successfully to block destruction of McMillan Park, a rare piece of green space in northwest D.C. Chantel James has more.
The auditorium of the Inspired Teaching Public Charter School was packed as more than 100 concerned citizens of Ward 5 gathered for a hearing and presentation given by the Department of General Services and the Department of Employment Services on the fate of McMillan Park, the historic property on the corners of North Capitol and Michigan that has been put under threat by developers. Although a December 2016 judgment would seem to have nixed the most ambitious plans of developers, the destiny of the park remains uncertain. The proposed project would increase traffic and pollution to the area by a large margin, and Ward 5 already sees one of the greatest rates of childhood asthma in the country. Gilles Stucker, Senior Project Manager of the Office of the Deputy Mayor for Planning and Economic Development of the Department, assured those gathered that this was only the first of many meetings on the issue. After a presentation by the D.C. government officials, the floor was open for a question and answer. The final questioner, Chris Otten, began to lead the crowd in chants of, "Hey, Mayor, back off it! Our park is not for profit." Tony Norman, lawyer, activist, and a member of Friends of McMillan, explains the urgency behind the turnout at the meeting.
The court put a stay on this project because there were serious concerns that the city hadn't addressed, particularly on the issue of gentrification and justifying a large, high-density project. And we feel that the city is trying to move forward in spite of the court order. And that's why I'm here tonight, to make sure they don't do that. And it's also a little bit of propaganda, too, because they're trying to emphasize, quote, jobs, when there's no guarantee that this project is going to bring those jobs. Most of the construction projects, they already have their workers when they come in and do the project. So that has not even been confirmed that there's going to be jobs or DC jobs. But I think that was just used as icing to try to attract people to say, you need to let us do this because it may bring jobs.
From the Inspire Teaching Public Charter School, this is Chantal James for On the Ground, signing off.
Now, that meeting was Thursday night, and the Save McMillan Park Coalition is planning a forum on March 24th at the UDC Law School to present more information about their legal victories and what they say are illegal actions by the city to build on the park site. And finally, in culture and media, the Oscar-nominated documentary I Am Not Your Negro about the writer James Baldwin opens in D.C. and nationally today. Lydia Curtis attended a community screening at Ballou High School in Southeast D.C. on Wednesday night. Director Raul Peck was on hand and thanked the Baldwin family for allowing him to make the film and allowing him access to all of Baldwin's personal documents. Peck said it took him more than 10 years to make the film. And when a student asked him how he stayed motivated that long, he said, "I had no choice. There, quote, there were a lot of people depending on this film and supporting the film. I had to keep going. I could not back out," end quote. Peck also said that he made the film so that no one would forget Baldwin. He said that people were beginning to quote Baldwin without saying that it is Baldwin, and that is dangerous. He said, "I did not use any talking heads. I wanted to bring Baldwin directly to you without someone interpreting his words." I Am Not Your Negro is based on the manuscript for a book James Baldwin never finished, in which he uses the deaths of three friends and colleagues, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., to describe race and racism in America. It is playing at several theaters in the DMV, including E Street Cinema in downtown D.C. Well, those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, more on applying the novel 1984 to 2017.
O'Brien was looking down at him speculatively. More than ever, he had the air of a teacher taking pains with a wayward but promising child. There is a party slogan dealing with the control of the past. Repeat it, if you please. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Winston repeated it obediently. "Who controls the present controls the past," said O'Brien, nodding his head with slow approval. "Is it your opinion, Winston, that the past has real existence?" Again, the feeling of helplessness descended upon Winston. His eyes flitted toward the dial. He not only did not know whether yes or no was the answer that would save him from pain, he did not even know which answer he believed to be the true one. O'Brien smiled faintly. You are no metaphysician, Winston. Until this moment, you had never considered what is meant by existence. I will put it more precisely. Does the past exist concretely in space? Is there somewhere or other a place, a world of solid objects, where the past is still happening? No. Then where does the past exist, if at all? In records. It's written down. In records. And in the mind, in human memories. In memory. Very well, then. We, the party, control all records, and we control all memories, and then we control the past, do we not?
But how can you stop people remembering things? Cried Winston, again momentarily forgetting the dial. It's involuntary. It is outside oneself. How can you control memory? You've not controlled mine.
O'Brien's manner grew stern again. He laid his hand on the dial. On the contrary, he said, you have not controlled it. That is what has brought you here.
You are here because you have failed in humility and self-discipline. You would not make the act of submission, which is the price of sanity. You preferred to be a lunatic, a minority of one. Only the disciplined mind can see reality, Winston. You believe that reality is something objective, external, existing in its own right. You also believe that the nature of reality is self-evident. When you delude yourself into thinking that you see something, you assume that everyone else sees the same thing as you. But I tell you, Winston, that reality is not external. Reality exists in the human mind and nowhere else. Not in the individual mind, which can make mistakes and in any case soon perishes. Only in the mind of the party, which is collective and immortal. And whatever the party holds to be truth is truth. It is impossible to see reality except by looking through the eyes of the party. That is the fact that you have got to relearn, Winston. It needs an act of self-destruction, an effort of the will. You must humble yourself before you can become sane.
You just heard an excerpt of the 1984 audiobook that is available in the 1300-hour audio package, Voices That Changed the World. Now, joining me via Skype to talk about applying the novel 1984 to 2017 is Bob Peterson, who taught fifth grade for 30 years in the public schools in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's a writer, organizer, and presenter, and a founding editor of the Rethinking Schools Project and a co-editor of several books, including Rethinking Columbus. He is author of the recent article, School Privatizer to Head U.S. Department of Education, and that's on the Education in Crisis website. Welcome to On the Ground, Bob.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And with me in studio is Vincent Intondi, coordinator for history and political science and an associate professor of history at the Tacoma Park Silver Spring campus of Montgomery College. Intondi is director of research for American University's Nuclear Studies Institute. He is the author of the book African Americans Against the Bomb, Nuclear Weapons, Colonialism, and the Black Freedom Movement on Stanford University Press. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start with you, Bob. That clip from the audio book that I just played was very chilling to me. O'Brien, the state representative and torturer of Winston, says that reality exists only in the mind of the party, which is collective and immortal. Whatever the party holds to be truth is truth. And it is impossible to see reality except by seeing through the eyes of the party. It needs an act of self-destruction. You must humble yourself before you can become sane. I thought it was a good intro to a discussion of the piece that you just wrote for the Education in Crisis website, School Privatizer to Head U.S. Department of Education. And I wonder if you could read the first three paragraphs of that piece for us.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. While it is doubtful that U.S. President-elect Donald Trump ever read George Orwell's 1984, Trump's cabinet choices appear to come right out of the doublethink that ruled Orwell's dystopian society. In Orwell's book, the Ministry of Plenty rationed essentials, while the Ministry of Truth manufactured falsehoods. Trump's pick for the Secretary of Energy said last year he wanted to abolish the department. His choice for the Environmental Protection Agency is best known for suing the agency. His proposed labor secretary has criticized overtime, minimum wage, and sick leave initiatives. His attorney general nominee has a long history of opposing voting rights, women's rights, and once said he decided he didn't like the white supremacist Ku Klux Klan only after he learned they smoked marijuana. However, Trump's choice for Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, is perhaps the most extreme of Trump's cabinet nominees. She has spent her entire adult life and her family's considerable wealth mounting campaigns to transfer public dollars away from public schools and into private and religious schools.
Wow. When I read that, I thought that the education of our children is, you know, a fertile, dangerous ground for creating a more Orwellian society. So what kind of impact could a Betsy DeVos have on the stability of public schools?
Well, it could have a huge impact, but she is a person who's, you know, never went to public schools, never sent her kids to public schools, never was a principal or a teacher or anybody. So she has very little knowledge of what happens in public schools, as exemplified by her the hearing she had in front of the Senate committee, when she said such things as thinking that schools should have guns in them to protect them from grizzly bears. That being said, her whole perspective is to demolish the public schools, to defund them, and to make the public schools a matter of the marketplace, to privatize them. Now, what's the double think here in terms of the comparison with Orwell's book is the fact that the use of the word choice by many of the proponents of privatization is really, on the one hand, you can understand everybody's for choice. On the other hand, choice in education means that we're going to eliminate the major public choice for students, which is happening in New Orleans and Milwaukee and other places. Because once you start privatizing and putting schools on the marketplace, basically what happens is the public school system, the only system in our communities that has the obligation, the legal, the capacity, and the commitment to serve all students, becomes destroyed or implodes. And so we can foresee, if she is nominated, and it's very close, on Monday we'll know, hopefully some moderate Republican will come to their senses, but she will probably initiate policies that will undermine the basic, essential component of a democracy, which is a public school system.
Vincent, as a historian, what has been your reaction to these comparisons to Orwell's 1984 and the Trump era so far? Most of the comparisons started after a Trump aide talked about alternative facts and about the size of the inauguration crowd. Some felt this was like doublespeak or newspeak in Orwell's book.
Yeah, I think that's valid. I think a couple of things. Especially when we look at education, and as somebody that's a history professor at a public college, what Bob's talking about is correct in that, but I think we have to be very careful because it'll happen in subtle ways. So, for example, instead of it being, we can see tangibly if she starts, more charter schools start coming and things of that nature. But where I'm concerned is something like the accreditation committees that are much more subtle and we don't think about. So a school really can't operate, can't get Pell Grants, we can't get federal funding, things of that nature, if we are not an accredited institution. So in case of, in this area, middle states or Sacs down in the South, they'll use those institutions. She will go through them to make sure that freedom of speech and certain dissent with professors, that stuff is squashed, because you won't be able to get accredited, and then you won't be able to get the money to do that. So you can see how these things will affect all our children's education right up through college. In terms of the historical nature, yes, I see why people want to read this book again, because you see that the double speak and the new speak that's in this book, and there's so many examples. I mean, we just literally in the last 24 hours had it again with this fake Bowling Green massacre that Kellyanne Conway just came out with. It literally didn't exist, but what'll happen is the old saying, you tell a lie often enough and frequent enough, it becomes truth. She will continuously just keep talking about it. His supporters will latch onto it. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, in the lexicon, we will be saying there was a Bowling Green massacre. Right. And this is right out of 1984. It's the same kind of thing where you're just constantly reiterating these things. And the media is a part of this. They certainly deserve criticism for this, the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. It's not alt-right. It's white supremacists. It's Nazis. It's not falsehoods. They're lies. We need to call them what they are. And we're not seeing enough of that.
In the academy, is the same thing happening? I know this week there was a major protests at Berkeley because this editor of Breitbart News came out there, and I mean, I guess he's known nationally as a provocateur. And watching the coverage of the media of this event, I saw that a lot of conservative media wanted to raise up this whole issue of freedom of speech and basically saying that his rights were being trampled on. Not that the protesters had a right to, which were mainly peaceful. You know, the black bloc got out there and start smashing windows again. But what do you see in the academy in terms of this argument around campuses?
So there's a couple things. One, I don't think my own personal opinion that smashing a window is violence. I think when Milo's supporters shot a protester a couple weeks beforehand, that's violence. So right. Let's be very clear on how we decide what is, you know, what is violence. We're freaking out of a Bank of America window being smashed when somebody's literally shot at a Milo speech a couple weeks before. I am a proponent of free speech and obviously a college for a college campus, but I think in terms of how we see that shaping up, it depends, one, on the school. For example, my school, my administration, is very, very supportive of allowing free speech and standing by students, especially our immigrant students and what's going on. Not every administration is going to be that way. When you have administrations that run their schools like businesses, when they come from a business background, MBAs and these kind of things, they haven't actually been in a classroom, then that's where you're going to have a problem. But it also is going to fall on faculty and students to rise up and do these things. I mean, I say that as somebody that when I was a student way back when at American University, I remember when Karl Rove came to campus and we organized our sit-in and laid between the wheels of his car. And it was, you know, the first, it was during the Iraq war, but we felt we had to do something. So, yeah, I think that if, you know, especially if Betsy DeVos gets in, our campuses should explode in nonviolent protest. I think we should have student walkouts. I think parents should be involved because it's their kids' education that we're seeing.
Now, Bob, how about in terms of what children learn in public schools? Can a secretary of education, if it is someone like Betsy DeVos, could she actually impact what's happening inside the classroom in terms of what's taught? She has strong links to the kind of Christian fundamentalist movement. I think, you know, she's a billionaire and she married a billionaire, and her mother is part of this, I think, Christian fundamentalist movement that is you know, has tried to make certain strategic fundings around the country. So what kind of impact could she have in the classroom?
Well, I think there's two different ways that she could have huge impact. First of all, by supporting and funding and getting public funds taken from public schools and put into private schools, there would be no public oversight of the curriculum in those schools. For example, Milwaukee, where I come from and live, has the largest voucher program, publicly funded voucher program in the country. There's over 120 private schools. Over $2 billion of public funds have been put into these private schools since the program started in 1990. And we have no clue what is being taught in these schools because they are not subject to open meeting, open records laws. They have no accountability by a democratically elected board. And thus, we know that in some of these schools, the sponsoring agencies, certain churches, for example, believe in creationism, believe that homosexuality is a sin, believe that two people living together without marriage is a sin. So you can imagine what the curriculum is. That will be more and more students will be exposed to that kind of curriculum. Now, in terms of the public schools, I would say even before she's been nominated, the impact of Trump has been disastrous because he has given license to both students and people in the community to use sexist, racist, homophobic, Islamophobic statements. And so there has been an increase. The Southern Poverty Law Center has done some surveys of teachers along with their group Teaching Tolerance and found there's a dramatic increase on the kind of bullying and statements in the schools. And now what impact that has on teachers is profound. On the one hand, some teachers and school districts are uniting together to say, no, this is not right, and we should teach children about the facts, and we should have open discussions about issues. However, in many communities, teachers who don't have as many rights in terms of the academic freedom of speech as the university level, these teachers, many of them are self-censoring because they're so afraid of what might happen to their jobs. Mm. And so this is a real dilemma that we face. Teachers have to stand up and take the political space that we can find collectively and do a good job of getting kids to look critically at what's going on in the world.
Wow, that's really scary, and it just further normalizes it. If you can imagine being a young child sitting in a classroom and either subjected to this type of racist, sexist, or bullying, and then not having the adult in the room who everyone is looking to for guidance and for not saying anything. It just normalizes it. I think I heard on the news recently some students in Dallas, Texas, with a Heil Hitler, Heil Trump chant or something. And if there's no adult saying, no, this is wrong, not because you don't have freedom of speech, but because it's racist, it's sexist, and it's dangerous, then it becomes normalized in young minds. That's really scary. I want to try and get in this other clip. We have another clip from the book, and we also have time to go to a brief break right now.
Borders, what's up with that? Politics, what's up with that? Police shots, what's up with that? Identities, what's up with that? Your privilege, what's up with that? Broke people, what's up with that? Broke people, what's up with that? The realness, what's up with that? The new world, what's up with that? I'm gonna keep up on all that. Guns close doors to the system, yeah. Come when we say we're not with them. We're solid and we don't need to kick them. This is North, South, East and Western.
Down in the street, little eddies of wind were whirling dust and torn paper into spirals. And though the sun was shining and the sky a harsh blue, there seemed to be no color in anything except the posters that were plastered everywhere. The black mustachioed face gazed down from every commanding corner. There was one on the house front immediately opposite. "Big Brother is watching you," the caption said, while the dark eyes looked deeply into Winston's own. Down at street level, another poster, torn at one corner, flapped fitfully in the wind, alternately covering and uncovering the single word Ingsos. In the far distance, a helicopter skimmed down between the roofs, hovered for an instant like a blue bottle, and darted away again with a curving flight. It was the police patrol snooping into people's windows. And the patrols did not matter, however, only the thought police mattered. Behind Winston's back, the voice from the telescreen was still babbling away about pig iron and the overfulfillment of the 9th 3-year plan. The telescreen received and transmitted simultaneously any sound that Winston made above the level of a very low whisper, would be picked up by it. Moreover, so long as he remained within the field of vision which the metal plaque commanded, he could be seen as well as heard. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment, how often or on what system the thought police plugged in on any individual wire was guesswork. It was even conceivable that they watched everybody all the time. But at any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. You had to live, did live, from habit that became instinct, in the assumption that every sound you made was overheard, and except in darkness, every movement scrutinized.
That is another portion of the audiobook, 1984, by George Orwell. I am in conversation right now with Bob Peterson and Vincent Intondi about 1984. And both of you, you know, official lies by the U.S. definitely are not new. You know, almost every war of aggression that we've been involved in has been, you know, kind of like the result of some type of lie. In just my lifetime, Vietnam, the first Gulf War, the invasion of Iraq. I remember the yellow ribbons in the 90s. It's crazy. And, you know, we support Israel, you know, which claims, and some people there claim that there were no Palestinians living in Palestine in 1948. So there are all kinds of lies associated with these wars. And for the most part, for Iraq especially, news organizations joined in the lie. So what are your thoughts about this? What makes this era evoke 1984 for so many people? You can start, Vincent.
Yeah, I was reminded, thinking of, there's a part in 1984 where there's the enemy of Eurasia, and then they just slip in East Asia and just use the different terms, which was supposed to be an ally. And I could, it's just something I could totally see Trump doing with Iraq and Iran and just sliding that in, you know, as he said he would go back into Iraq to get that oil. And now we see the constant lies on Iran that we gave them $150 billion, not true, that they are breaking all these agreements, not true. And now all of this, they were putting them on notice, and we're going to have a red line, and you can just see where this is going. And if he it's so you can just see that how he could drum up that anti-Iranian sentiment in this country. We've seen it before. You mentioned, you know, Gerald Horn is looking at Japanese internment, and he's right, because after Pearl Harbor, there was a genocidal race hatred in this country. 85% of the American public agreed with using nuclear weapons on Japan. 22% wish they hadn't surrendered, so we could have dropped more. So you could see how this whipping up can happen in a lead up to war.
Bob, did you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you, first of all, that the leaders in our country, the rulers of our country, have used lies throughout history to make their point and to cover their tracks. The thing about Trump, which is so clear, is that he's brazen in his use of lies. He's proud of it, and he keeps on repeating them, and without any real attempt to document what he's saying. And thus, it becomes a phenomena where people just hear it so often, I think a lot of people will start believing it. And his use of, I mean, it's also his use of Twitter and the role of social media has amplified, I think, the effectiveness of the big lie theory. Now, it also has amplified our ability to resist, too. And I think the Women's March and the spontaneous demonstrations at the airports this last weekend show how working together collectively, those who want to resist can fight back even on social media in a very effective way. But it's frightening because it's so clear. I mean, he recently said, just I think yesterday, that we've been taken advantage of by virtually every country in the world. He said that after he hung up on the Australian leader. Just such outrageous statements. Obviously, many of us don't believe, but when he repeats them and repeats them, it's very Orwellian.
Orwellian indeed. We have another clip from the book.
Winston was lying on something that felt like a camp bed, except that it was higher off the ground, and that he was fixed down in some way so that he could not move. Light that seemed stronger than usual was falling on his face. O'Brien was standing at his side, looking down at him intently. And at the other side of him stood a man in a white coat holding a hypodermic syringe. Even after his eyes were open, he took in his surroundings only gradually. He had the impression of swimming up into this room from some quite different world, a sort of underwater world far beneath it. How long he had been down there he did not know. Since the moment when they arrested him, he had not seen darkness or daylight. Besides, his memories were not continuous. There had been times when consciousness, even the sort of consciousness that one has in sleep, had stopped dead and started again after a blank interval. But whether the intervals were of days or weeks or only seconds, there was no way of knowing. With that first blow on the elbow, the nightmare had started. Later, he was to realize that all that then happened was merely a preliminary, a routine interrogation to which nearly all prisoners were subjected. There was a long range of crimes, espionage, sabotage, and the like, to which everyone had to confess as a matter of course. The confession was a formality, though the torture was real. How many times he had been beaten, how long the beatings had continued, he could not remember. Always there were five or six men in black uniforms at him simultaneously. Sometimes it was fists, sometimes it was truncheons, sometimes it was steel rods, sometimes it was boots. There were times when he rolled about the floor as shameless as an animal, writhing his body this way and that, in an endless, hopeless effort to dodge the kicks and simply inviting more and yet more kicks in his ribs, in his belly, on his elbows, on his shins, in his groin, in his testicles, and on the bone at the base of his spine. There were times when it went on and on until the cruel, wicked, unforgivable thing seemed to him not that the guards continued to beat him, but that he could not force himself into losing consciousness. There were times when his nerves so forsook him that he began shouting for mercy even before the beating began, when the mere sight of a fist drawn back for a blow was enough to make him pour forth a confession of real and imaginary crimes. There were other times when he started out with the resolve of confessing nothing, when every word had to be forced out of him between gasps of pain. And there were times when he feebly tried to compromise, when he said to himself, "I will confess, but not yet. I must hold out till the pain becomes unbearable. Three more kicks, two more kicks, and then I'll tell them what they want." Sometimes he was beaten till he could hardly stand, then flung like a sack of potatoes onto the stone floor of a cell, left to recuperate for a few hours, and then taken out and beaten again. There were also longer periods of recovery. He remembered them dimly because they were spent chiefly in a sleep or stupor. He remembered a cell with a plank bed, a sort of shelf sticking out from the wall, and a tin wash basin, and meals of hot soup and bread and sometimes coffee. He remembered a surly barber arriving to scrape his chin and crop his hair, and businesslike, unsympathetic men in white coats, feeling his pulse, tapping his reflexes, turning up his eyelids, running harsh fingers over him in search of broken bones, and shooting needles into his arm to make him sleep. The beatings grew less frequent and became mainly a threat, a horror to which he could be sent back at any moment when his answers were unsatisfactory.
You just heard an excerpt of the 1984 audiobook. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining me in the discussion, Vincent and Tondi here in the studio, and Bob Peterson joining me via Skype. And also thank my guest earlier, Gerald Horn. Also thanks to Chantel James, Lydia Curtis, and Michael Byfield for their contributions. And thank you to Mark Torres of the Pacifica Radio Archives for putting together such a wonderful package and for assisting me in the production. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella, and thank you for listening. You can reach our show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. We're also on iTunes. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On The Ground Show. I need to get some more likes on that Facebook page. I'm Esther Avera. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
say another thing? I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time. I'll give it right back to you one of these days.